Okay, well, welcome back, Mallory.
Thanks, Chris. It's good to be here.
And so pretty much everyone on this side of things has listened to the part one of the show. And so we were kind of in the middle of talking about the Venus retrograde. And I know I listened to you on Radio Free Golgotha talking about the Kazemi. And I know that you had some thoughts about that. Do you want to talk about what the inferior conjunction of Venus and the Sun might look like this time?
Yeah, so the inferior conjunction for Venus and also for Mercury actually is sort of it's an axis. It's similar to the full moon or the new moon. And it is the point where Venus has kind of ventured down into the underworld to be reborn, renewed. It's very similar, I find, in resonance to the myth of Inanna's descent into the underworld and how she's gradually stripped of her garments and her jewels and her flesh and leaves behind everything in order to have this moment of like total orgasmic renewal. And so Kazemis are very precise moments in time. They are basically the moment of the exact conjunction, I think within, is it what, 16, 13 minutes?
Yeah, I've heard 16 and 13, and then I've also heard from somewhere else like 20, I think 23. And I don't know if mm-hmm. that's like just someone saying like, oh, I've observed it up to that point, you know?
Interesting.
But
yeah, I mean, how do we know any of this?
Less than a minute, you know?
Less than a minute. Minutes in terms of space versus time, because the subdivision of a degree within a zodiacal sign is a minute, but then a minute is also a unit of time.
Right, totally. Yeah, I meant less than a degree.
Yeah.
Less than a minute, yeah.
So you have to be really, really careful when you're using them magically, because it's so easy to kind of miss that moment. And consequently, it's kind of dangerous. It has this like air of danger about it if you're into that sort of thing, because Venus conjunct the Sun, she's completely invisible, so basically non-existent in a way astrologically during that time. And so it's like you're either going to get this super-powered Venus who is, you know, blazing in the heart of the Sun, or nothing. So it's like extremely hit or miss.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was thinking while you were saying that, like when you're like, for people who are into that, if like you find during this Venus retrograde in Scorpio that what your fetish is doing like sketchy Kazemi elections, you know?
Yeah.
Like, maybe do your first one then and see if you like it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're really interesting. I have Venus conjunct the Sun, but outside, just outside of the Kazemi. I think it's like up to like 45 minutes and like natally. And so, yeah, I've looked at it a lot, and it's interesting because I totally can see it in my life, you know, as just like Venus obsessed, you know, and like Venus, definitely Venus like super powered, but in a way that it's like, oh, everything Venus that you do is kind of scary and nasty and not for everybody, you know, like, but still gives it like a lot of gas, you know? So I can see that danger of the, as an election, you know, like I love it like personally, like natally, but if you were just going to like try to get that Kazemi and you got outside of those suggested parameters by tradition, you could be like, yeah, it worked, but it got really weird rather than nothing, you know?
Yeah. And if that's not what you're used to,
then
it might not be what you're configured to desire, so to speak.
Yeah, totally.
And one of the, in natal astrology, sometimes when we see planets conjunct the Sun, we'll talk about them being, it's like this conflation of, you know, the true will, or, you know, your soul's purpose or what have you, and whatever that other planet signifies. So like with Mercury, for example, it can be, you know, a conflation of the intellect and the ego, which makes it difficult to think about things objectively. But I see that in what you're saying about your Venus-Sun conjunction, where it sounds like there is this blending that is happening between, your experience of the divine and the drive, the energy that comes from being tapped into the divine, and all of the things that fall under Venus's rulership.
Yeah, totally. And it's so it's like as far as like the Inanna in the underworld, it's like if you're slightly off that Kazemi, you're not at this the this moment where she gets to turn around after where she gets revived, right? Probably after being on the meat hook, by Arishkigal, where she gets to turn around and escape the underworld. You might be in the portion of the Kazemi where, she's faced with one of the seven judges of the underworld, right? And
Right, exactly.
like where you're and that's like that's the where we get the dance of the seven veils, right? Where she's like forced to remove a garment along the way to as she's being stripped down, like the process where the sun is burning away from Venus, all the things that are like all the stuff that you used to like, or you used to be into, or used to be attracted to, or used to get pleasure from, that just like kind of has gone stale. Like during this, that's like that's the stance of seven veils. So you, especially in Scorpio, you're removing garments. So there's like that erotic connotation that as you're stripping yourself down, you're getting closer to like your primary kind of erotic and sensual state and finding out like really what it is, like when we say like we really love something, like absolutely, like it blows our mind on that Venus level aesthetically. We're like, oh my God, that kills me, I'm dead, I think that's that like Inanna, like finally when she ultimately just snaps, it's almost like how the French call the orgasm the little death, it's like that moment of pleasure that just is like it cuts the cord,
Yeah, absolutely. And that each one of those veils, each one of the things that she's relinquishing, maybe it's not that it's a bad veil, it's not that it's bad clothing or bad jewelry, it's just that everything has to go at some point. And things that, we're holding on to, because the biggest danger, I think, in some ways when you're doing magical work is you see that something is working, and so you become superstitious about it. You hold on to it even when it's no longer working, because you're afraid that if you give it up, that you'll never be able to get back to that state that you were in when you first got it. And I think in, when you're working with certain plant allies who are associated with purgation, and with vomiting and or other ways of letting go of things through the body. It's so awful when it's like happening, but then afterwards there's that moment of just absolute bliss where you realize like, oh my God, the worst thing wasn't actually, throwing up, but it was having that inside of me all along. And if I had kept that in me, how much pain that would have caused me every day just having it inside. And it's worth that moment of intense discomfort to be able to live with greater freedom.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, Jupiter's been in Scorpio for almost 13 months, and that like coherence and ability to understand and to like quantify and see what it means to have like these poisons in our life brought in back up and look at them and be like, well, is there, can we clean this off and see if there's an opportunity in that and sorting through that. And I've been seeing it a lot with clients who have a lot of planets in Scorpio that they for some people it's really great and for other people it's really painful, but it's like doing that that shadow work, say, but as Venus moves into that place after for a year, we've kind of been sorting through there, like in our minds or on, from a philosophical standpoint, like starting to understand it. Venus like roots us back into like actually how it feels, that we're like that, like on that, on a visceral level or on a sensual level, like what, like what you're saying, being like, I can't believe I have that inside of me, like that feeling versus this feeling of no longer having it,
Yeah, because there's just so much complex information that the body is conveying to us at all times. complex information that would be really hard to write down or describe out loud or quantify. And yeah, in many ways, just experiencing something here in the physical world is an initiatic experience. That, you know, the difference between, like, I remember when I was in high school and I had never smelled marijuana before. And it's like, for some reason, that is the plant that everybody kind of points to as, like, nobody can describe what it smells like, but everybody knows it once they know it, kind of.
Yeah.
And I was just like, so curious. Like, I want to know what this magic smelly plant is.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you have these experiences and, you know, you can't necessarily explain them to people. You can't necessarily describe them. And this is a thing I think that we encounter in the occult or the magical community a lot, is the occult community tends to mistake reading about something for having actually experienced it.
Yeah.
And you might have read a lot about something and you might understand the history of it and you might be able to rattle off a bunch of facts about it, but that doesn't mean that you've actually experienced it with all of your senses.
Yeah.
And we need to go out and seek experience, and we need to listen to people who have had experience. And yes, I love books and I love reading and I love, you know, intellectual pursuits, but that can't be a substitute for being in the world.
Yeah, absolutely not. Yeah. And so why don't we then talk about your experiences on pilgrimage then?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I mentioned on the show before, I just got back from Italy about a month ago, month and a half. And I was there with my teacher, Alessandra Belloni, and I've been studying drumming and dance and song with her for about 3 years now. And tarantella is an umbrella term for the folk music of Italy, particularly southern Italy. And there's many forms of tarantella, which are based in different regional areas. The two that I know the best are the pizzica from Puglia and the tamburiata from Naples, from Campania. And what Alessandra does, which is really unique, is she has an emphasis on the spiritual context of these musical traditions and really looks at their use in ritual, in spirituality, in devotion to especially the Black Madonna, who she's extremely devoted to, and how can we take these traditions, which are, you know, very popular in Italy today. There's lots of big festivals devoted to these different types of tarantella. And how do we take that and bring it another step forward into an animistic worldview, where we're no longer just getting up on stage and playing a song, perhaps a little bit superstitiously, but instead, you know, making it real, making it magic.
Yeah. And so there's like an emphasis on like on doing it as a working then, right?
Yeah, she does, particularly the pizzica tarantata, she does as a ritual, which is very resonant with the themes that we've been discussing with regard to Venus retrograde. It is very much about encountering the poison in your body and working through it through ecstatic dance. And under the, you know, under the kind of healing influence of the drum, because the drum is a very powerful instrument when it comes to just completely rewiring your brain, your body, your everything, your spirit. And so she really emphasizes that, that aspect of it, and she regularly does workshops actually, where she'll, you know, bring people into the ritual space and, help them to release what it is that they're holding on to.
Yeah, just to jump around a little bit, as you mentioned, ecstatic dance. We get, you know, the new moon in this month in Libra, so that's like gonna tune up to that beginning episode of the Venus retrograde, and then we get the full moon in Taurus, conjunct Uranus, as we had chatted about before, that
Yeah.
looks really juicy and insane. And I was talking of, you were talking about how it's like so good, it's bad. You kind of want to just like attack it with magic anyway.
Yeah, it's like it's so bad it's good. It's
Oh, right.
like,
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
yeah,
it's
right. I
so
said it backwards.
exact. The conjunction between the moon and Uranus is so close at the moment of the full moon that it's like, you know, it's such a bad idea, but I want it.
Yeah, and I was kind of thinking of like the way to insulate against it was like as we've had Uranus in Taurus, it's been sextile pretty closely, but also by sign with Saturn in Capricorn, and it seems like Saturn in Capricorn has given us like a much more sober time period in general, where people are kind of getting their shit together. But and being, you know, like getting off drugs or like getting their diet under control or whatever. But it's like a less like fun, wild time period, you know, like letting it all hang loose. So Saturn's like been allowing us to kind of schedule in an ecstatic experiences, like on like he's like, as long as you put it in the schedule and you're responsible about it, it's like starts here and it ends there. Then like he's like, be my guest, you know. So
No,
maybe
I totally get that.
This is a good night for working in a in like a Tarantismo modality.
Yeah, potentially. I don't want to give medical advice on the air. But you know, your listeners can make their own decisions about this.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's funny like the medical advice, because I was looking back through some articles that were talking about it was a part of a wider kind of phenomenon of medicine in the 1500s and throughout the Renaissance, where they iatro musica, which tarantella would be a form of, which it's like music therapy, was something that was pursued.
Oh yeah, and so tarantella is as I was saying before, it's an umbrella term, and a related word is tarantismo, which refers to this epidemic of ecstatic dance, where it was really common throughout southern Italy for hundreds of years, and typically the mythic structure is someone, usually a woman, would be out in the fields, working the fields, and she would be bit by a spider, sometimes a snake or a scorpion, and she would fall gravely, gravely ill. And the only known cure for this type of illness was an ecstatic dance ritual, which would usually last between 3 and 7 days of, you know, nonstop, no sleeping, you know, not necessarily a lot to eat. There would be a little bit of wine, but it wasn't as though people were just kind of getting drunk and that was it. There was something else going on which made this ecstatic dance ritual happen. And when we look at this mythic structure, I noticed that it's very similar to Zar, which is a spirit possession cult that's found in places like Sudan, Somalia, Egypt, Ethiopia, that kind of North African area. And I just find these parallels really interesting. I think there's also some parallels that can be found with African traditional religions and Afro-diasporic traditions. But Zar really has a lot of like eerily parallels, in which case you might be able to make some inferences about what this was, and how it relates to the conscious awareness of the spirit world that existed in southern Italy.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole looking into Czar, I was which I hadn't before, we had chatted about it before the show, but I was struck by some of the language and some of the construction, how it certainly has like a hierarchy of spirits with a legion underneath them in the Ethiopian variants, and in the southern Iran variants, they talk about the spirits as like a harmful wind, you know, so it's like aerial. And so it really like smacks of grimoires as well. And
Absolutely.
which is interesting, as I mentioned to you, that you get so Naples as a nexus of grimoires at a time period, but and then and all these Italian variants of various manuscripts. So and of course you can kind of connect Italy back to like the greater Greek world in general. And there's various people have like proposed that the earlier like Dionic or Dionysiac cult origins of Tarantella and Tarantismo. I think what they're talking about probably is from the story of Proetus, the king of Argos, whose daughters go mad when they become mature, and they're only healed after Melampus it cures them, but he has all these ultimatums about how he wants the Proetus's land to be split up and given to him, and he wants to marry into the family. But he's often one of the people who linked to Orphism, who gained an ability to speak with animals through saving these snakes from being killed, and was attributed by Herodotus to be the who introduced Dionysus worship in general. So it's interesting that you get it's snakes instead of spiders, but you get this figure who comes in and is like, oh, well, I know how to cure these women through Dionysian dance and music, and I also can communicate with venomous creatures, you know.
And the snake, in addition to the spider, is a common motif in the tradition. The holy power who was called on most often in Puglia was Saint Paul, San Paolo, or Santo Paolo. And he, of course, is depicted holding a sword and often surrounded by snakes. And so this is, I think, the only reason why he is the particular saint who is associated with the tradition. I don't think it has anything to do with the biblical Paul. I think it has to do entirely with his heraldry, because some of the forms of dance that we find associated with the pizzica involve swords or knives. And then, of course, the creature that bites the person who becomes afflicted, it can be a snake. So having the sword and the snake together in your heraldry is like actually a pretty good match for describing what people were apparently kind of seeing and experiencing when they were in this state.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I was trying to knowing that, a lot of the 3 or 7 days of dancing would end at a church of Saint Paul or at a statue of Saint Paul. And I was like, well, how is Paul related to this? And thinking about how he had a handicap that he referred to as being like a thorn in his flesh, and Paul and Simon Magus and levitation, and but it wasn't really like doing it for me, you know. So it's interesting to hear that other perspective on it. And it is also like the prevalence of Saint Michael in southern Italy too, like where you get those like geomantic chains of Saint Michael, and like the sword and the dragon, it's probably comes up like repeatedly in southern Italy.
Oh yeah, Saint Michael is extraordinarily popular. We haven't been able to find yet a source for that geomantic chain, but my husband, Dr. Alexander Cummins, who is a geomancer, he loves that modality. And we have found people who do coin-based geomantic divination in Calabria.
Oh, cool.
So even if that geomantic chain was somebody's individual kind of innovation, it probably reflects a broader pattern of doing geomancy with coins.
So,
But yeah, Saint Michael, very, very popular and often a kind of psychopomp figure, and someone who, even though he's an angel and thus in a way less related to the dead than the other saints who are by and large dead humans, he has this kind of relationship with the dead.
Yeah, and I knew I know an uncle of mine who was heavily he was like a paranoid schizophrenic and was heavily disturbed by demons throughout his life. You know, he loved Saint Michael. He was like, absolutely, Saint Michael was like, seemed to like be the thing that like held him together, you know?
Yeah.
And the Velvet Underground. Yeah. So why do you think spiders then?
Why spiders? Well, I mean, they're not actually, as far as I can tell, they were not actually spiders. They were most likely, as we see in Tsar, spirits of the dead, who were, you know, spider was kind of like the code word for it.
Interesting.
And that might be, you know, that might be a Greek thing, the myth of Arachne, you know, the young girl who was very proud and boasted that her weaving was better even than the goddess Athena. And so she challenged Athena to a weaving contest, won the contest, and then Athena, you know, in her rage, smashed her weaving, and Arachne, out of shame, committed suicide. But Athena decided to turn her into a spider, either as an act of mercy or as a curse. There's a lot of ambiguity in this story. And I remember reading it as a child in this like comic book of Greek myths and being like, what is the moral here? Like, who is the good guy? Who's the bad guy? Who did what wrong? Why?
Which are so much more like real stories, like real life, you know?
Yeah.
And dry,
So I'm not sure exactly why the spider became the most important kind of heraldic symbol for this particular, what I believe was probably a class of aerial spirits and spirits of the dead. What we see in the descriptions of tarantismo when it was being practiced was that the person who was afflicted by the spirit would be put through a curative process where they had to kind of figure out what the spirit's identity was, or at the very least, what the spirit was into, which is, you know, great going with our themes of Venus and Scorpio. You know, what are you into? What's your kink? And so they would have the musicians go through and play just like every type of music that they could think of to watch for what rhythms and what style, you know, is this a melancholic spirit or is it a manic spirit? What does the body of the afflicted or possessed person respond to? And when they found the right one, the person would just jump up and start kind of responding. Often they would dance. Sometimes they would want to do other things. But they do the same thing with color as well, where the women from the village would bring out all of their colorful clothes and like put them down in front of the afflicted person and let her pick the color and dress herself as the spirit wanted to be dressed in the colors that resonated with that spirit. And so what this cure would look like varied a lot from spirit to spirit and person to person. And eventually, if done successfully, I think the spirit would be inclined to kind of divulge a little bit about their identity. And my hypothesis is they would probably be amenable to creating a kind of magical pact with the person that they had possessed.
Yes.
Yeah. And so this is really interesting, as you said, for this particular Venus retrograde, as we were talking about journaling and experiencing it, and that you could actually do some sort of version of this just for yourself, not obviously in possession with these specific spirits or in this tradition, but you could get into states where you're allowing yourself to be more ecstatic, say through drumming, and allowing yourself to wear certain costumes. And I think you were talking about this when we were chatting back and forth, right? About looking in the mirror with different makeup and like writing down your results and listening to different music and really paying attention to what you aesthetically value, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And better if you can do it with friends. You know, if you can be if you can be the person who's going through the cure and they can kind of manage you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, as much as you can, try to get the setup going before you enter an altered state of consciousness, or before you start doing that kind of deep psychological work. You know, have the colorful scarves ready to go.
Yeah, yeah.
Have, you know, the playlist ready. You know, maybe have some fresh water and some, you know, fresh plants nearby. That was also a common element of the ritual. But then, you know, really just allow that desire, that sensual desire to lead you through it, which can be, oh my God, this can be so difficult for people sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think especially for women in this culture where, you know, I've met so many grown-ass women who have never had an orgasm before.
Mm.
And, you know, or never masturbated. And it's like, you know, it really kind of blows my mind, but it also goes to show just how alienated a lot of us are from our bodies and mm-hmm. how we're uncomfortable seeking our own pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so this retrograde is going to push people into seeking our own pleasure, like kind of like, as we were saying, dangerously, even if they're not careful. So this kind of engaging with something, you know, it's like how astrology remediation of oncoming astrological weather kind of works anyway. It's like you're going to get this transit. So pick your version of it before it just lands on you, you know?
Yeah.
So doing some sort of activity like this, you know, like you're saying, with friends and with everything prepared, can really probably, that could be, it could end up being the event of the retrograde rather than something unforeseen just coming and broadsiding you, you know?
Coming to these little parties.
Right. Yeah.
It sounds fabulous.
And yeah, and it's its own thing rather than Tarantismo, even though Tarantismo is what like informed us of the, of a variety of medicine like this. But within the tradition itself, do you want to explain to people kind of what the rhythms are like and what the feeling of the music is?
Yeah. So we have, as I was saying before, the two styles that I've been training in are the tamburiato, which is from Campania. And this is devotional music that is dedicated to the Madonna. Particularly, there are seven sisters, they're called the Sette Sorelle.
Mm-hmm.
And these are very famous Madonnas in Campania, including the Madonna di Montevergine, who is a black Madonna and the one that I'm the most devoted to. And the rhythm is a 4-4 rhythm. So it's like, you know, what we're most of us are used to in terms of the type of music that we listen to. And it's a very loud style. So it's very hard to like practice in New York because it's, you know, it's meant to be played like out on top of a mountain you know, with thousands of your closest friends who are all just kind of dedicating, you know, a day to the Madonna. That's the other thing with these traditions, is they traditionally were never played up on a stage with this kind of you know, gaping chasm between the musician and the audience.
Yeah,
they were usually played at a festa, that is a, you know, a religious festival. And, you know, with the musicians kind of standing in a circle and then the dancers inside of the circle,
mm-hmm.
which is a very, very powerful way to contain the energy. And the drum itself becomes this kind of symbol of the magic circle. It's actually referred to as the magic circle sometimes in Italian. The drum, of course, you know, it resembles the moon, especially because you have the subtle discolorations, on the goat. They often use goat skin to make the drum in Italy. And even the synthetic ones that we have in the US, are usually dyed to look way. So they look a lot like the moon, the singer, when they don't use a microphone, obviously, because, you know, they didn't even have electricity, you know, you're up on a mountain. So the singer will often sing into the back of the drum, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's sort of like putting your iPhone in a bowl. It gets, the voice gets amplified naturally. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, you've got this circle of musicians and dancers, and then you've got the circle that is the drum, the circle that is the moon, the circle that is holding the sound, all of it is kind of like circular, as opposed to, okay, there's a line of musicians on the stage and then a line that divides the musicians from the audience. And then the audience is organized into lines if they're in a venue that has seating.
Yep.
Wow. That's
much different.
Yeah. That's amazing. As you know, part of what we try to do in the show is this connection between astrology, magic, arts, culture, and music so that inspiration can flow both ways. And what we spoke to our last guest about for a while was, it keeps coming up how to break up the kind of stale format of like performers are on stage or in front of the audience. And then the audience just like is a big wall, a big block that just observes them, you know? And he was talking about getting back into like a PA system. Whenever you see any performance, it's in stereo.
Yeah.
And he was talking about getting back to quadraphonic sound and having like the four sources of sound in a performance space, like in a concert hall, be to the cardinal directions. But
that's
then
awesome.
Yeah. But then this whole arrangement you're talking about is like another version of that. It's like, okay, how about like the performers are in a circle and the audience is in the center, and there's kind of no other option at that point but to move. Like you almost have to dance because you have to look every direction to see the performance, you know?
Yeah. And there's something, one of the moments in my life that was very subtle but also made a huge difference was I was sitting around with my godbrother Demetrius, and we were watching YouTube videos, and he is in Vodou. He's initiated in Vodou, and he was showing me some voodoo rituals. And he showed me one where there was a young man who was struggling with being mounted by Loa, and so he was trying to get away from the drum. And Demetrius explained to me that sometimes when people are about to be mounted, it can result in a feeling which is kind of like similar to, it's not very comfortable. It can feel like you're about to purge. Mm-hmm. And so if the drum is kind of causing that, the natural inclination is to move away from the drum and to like go get a breath of fresh air or go to the bathroom. And what the people in the video were doing is they were throwing him back towards the drum so he could mount and the discomfort would pass because he'd be mounted, of course.
Yeah.
And I think about that a lot, how often the cure for when you're starting to feel that type of spiritual discomfort is not to get a breath of fresh air, not to stop, not to go to the bathroom, but to move towards the drum, to move towards the thing that's making you uncomfortable, because you need to let it completely take over you and to wash over you. And when you have people in a circle, there's no other option. There's nowhere to run, so to speak.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, it's an entire environment. And it's interesting that as the version of an inversion almost of the magical circle that protects you from what might come to the edge of the circle. In this case, like this circle is like everything at the edge of the circle is like kind of is pushing you back in, you know, is pushing against you rather than the other way around. But that ultimately they have your best interests in mind, you know, even if they're pushing you further into initiation, you know?
Yeah. And that, you know, what is someone's best interest in the moment? Like,
yeah.
I don't know, actually.
yeah, totally.
But we hold each other in community. And that's, you know, the only way to do magic safely, if there is a way to do it safely, is in community. That's really the key. Like, I know this is, My Little Pony got it right. Like, friendship is magic. And I'm so proud to say that in public. Like, if I get, you know, 30 seconds with a microphone, I'm going to mention that. We have each other for a reason, and the only way to do this is with each other.
Absolutely. In the notes and the back and forth that you and Chris did, you had wrote that the real pilgrimage begins when you return home. Did you want to talk about that?
I think this is a really important lesson, I think, for a lot of people. First of all, I just want to talk a little bit about the concept of pilgrimage, because I think it is a necessity for a lot of people who are living, you know, maybe in the United States, for example, where we don't always have active spiritual communities that are able to provide for all of our needs. And so we have this need to kind of like go out and explore, and that's a part of who we are, and it's not like a bad thing necessarily, but it does often result in unintended consequences like cultural appropriation or spiritual tourism. And people with a lot of means, usually white, usually from the global north, going to the global south and kind of injecting an unstable cash flow into communities that are not really well equipped to handle that. And it's a very complicated thing, and something that I think we all need to be constantly sort of questioning ourselves and what are our motivations when, we book a trip to the Amazon to drink ayahuasca, and how do we maintain ourselves as adults and hold ourselves accountable for the impact that we're having on our local community and the global community. But at the same time, there are lots of spiritual traditions where pilgrimage has always been a part of it. And especially with the Madonnas in southern Italy, they are meant to be experienced through pilgrimage by people who are not local. Usually they're in locations where there isn't a community locally. They're off up on the top of a mountain or out in the middle of nowhere. So their devotees have always been pilgrims, and often been international pilgrims. Mm-hmm. And so this is actually like a completely legitimate traditional way to experience them, is by going to visit them and then taking a little piece of that local ecosystem, whether it's, the sacred oil that you can get at Montevergine or in Foggia in Puglia, or some holy water from the church, or even just a little statue or a holy card, and then taking that back into your home altar and, transplanting it and getting it to grow in the local soil. And that's really, I think, what I mean when I say the real pilgrimage begins when you get home, is because you now have something extra with you. You have the little bottle of oil, but you also have the spiritual counterpart of that that's inside of you and taking root. And maybe it's causing a little bit of discomfort. Maybe there's stuff that you need to do in order to clear out your life, in order to better accommodate it or to nurture it, or whatever it is that particular shred of the divine that you've taken with you needs in order to, flourish.
Yeah, absolutely. And I especially, it could be nice. It could be lovely. Like, I love what you said about, the flora and in your the microorganisms in your gut. And also, when we were chatting, you were talking about, having a bottle of wine at home connects you with that land. In actuality, as like a physical spirit. And I thought really brilliant praxis was you were suggesting pairing wine with the music from that region.
I love that. I think I want to start doing that too. Yeah. Absolutely.
Totally. Do it. It's, wine is a living organism. It is a living organism in a bottle. And another kind of traveling pro tip is to find the fermented food from the region that you're going to, because you might have some issues with like the water there or what have you. And if you're experiencing like GI inflammation because of that, just eat the fermented foods and it'll help to, get your digestion back on track. But the other side of that is there's such a close connection between our gut biome and like our spiritual body and the way that we feel.
Yeah.
And there's even been studies that have shown that depression is linked to not having a healthy ecosystem in your stomach. And that one very easy way that you can help nurture your mental health, or what we'd call mental health in this culture, is to just start like taking some probiotics, eat some kimchi, some yogurt. Like I was saying, if you can pair the music and the wine from a particular region, you're getting like a better picture, like a fuller picture. It's almost like You know how with printing you have the same image and it's done in one color, then another, you know, like cyan, magenta, and yellow is the, I'm not a printer, sorry. But if you can see the same image, but with three different lenses, you know, the food, the wine, the music, or for me, more often, it's the image, the wine, the music. So drinking a glass of wine from Puglia while listening to Pizzica, while gazing at an image of San Paolo, like something that you wouldn't have perceived if you were just drinking that glass of wine or just listening to that music or just looking at that image becomes perceptible when you align all three.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I was thinking about the music and the wine together instantly is like, oh, well, there you have like a Dionysian complete, you know, like it's actual, it's bacchanal at that point, you know, you have the wine and you have the song, you know, it's a, and it's so easy to do, be like, okay, where's the region of origin of this wine? And then on YouTube, just bring up the music. But for people who work with chthonic spirits and underworld spirits and etc., it's a, just kind of a sideline way to live your life. Even just be like, oh yeah, I listen to the music of, you know, of where the grapes come from. Like that is, in a sense, it's an Orphic practice, you know?
Yeah. And so much of the music from Southern Italy, at least, is related to agriculture. In Puglia, where the Pizzica comes from, the drums were literally made when the like a, the sieve that was being used to sift the earth would break, the mesh part would break. And so they'd just take that little circle of wood and replace the front of it with the goat skin. And the movements that the musician makes or used to make, I think it's kind of evolved a bit, are just the same movements that you would make when you are using the sieve, but now you're striking the drum head too.
Oh, wow.
So the, and a lot of like the lore around how do you strike the drum and what do any of these things mean are, it's inextricable from the lore around agriculture and what it means to work the land and to be conscious of particularly the relationship between solar lunar cycle and the growth of the crops. But that's a big thing in Italy today because the music is experiencing a renaissance, but the people who are playing it are no longer working in the field, and so they're missing part of the story and you know, learning the music, but outside of that traditional context. But it's something that we can, you know, you don't have to quit your job and go work as a farmer to like learn what foods are in season in your region, or like learn where the water that you drink comes from, or to take any of these kind of baby steps towards having a conscious awareness of the land that you live on and like how you are interacting with it at all times.
So one thing I did want to get back to was when we were talking about who are these spirits in Tarantismo and talking about Tsar and how these seem to be the same spirits or related cult of spirits or culture of spirits, and talking about like goetic threads that passed through there, and the area being like Taranto is, how do you say that? Like the place?
Galatina.
Galatina, or the, like, there's a, the village of Taranto, right? Like within that?
Yeah, I think Taranto might be the province.
Province, okay, yeah.
Region, broader region.
Yeah, I read that. It was founded in 706 BC by Dorian Greek immigrants who, and it was the only Spartan colony. And that, so easily, like these, the Greek traditions we're talking about easily are like some of the threads that were transplanted there. And it's where Pythagoras settled and led, is one of the places where like he may have spent the rest of his life and died. So he had he had followers there as well. And there's Richard Mead in 1702 suggested that Tarantismo was a musical, theatrical therapy cult of medicine that's Pythagorean. So all these different things, like, so these are actual spirits that come from different places. I just was wondering what your take is on, like, who exactly are these spirits that actually live in this space, and how might they have gotten there, and what is, what's their mission, and, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think they are, it's kaleidoscopic, really. They're the spirit world is so vast, even bigger than our own world. And I think within Czar, you tend to find that the spirits will reflect, maybe not the exact village, but they do reflect, you know, they're like digestible. No, that's not the right word. But they correspond with things that people who are practicing the religion will identify, even if it's not their culture. It might be, you know, the culture of a neighboring village. And so there's a specificity which points to them being the spirits of deceased people, with the understanding that maybe you could actually, like, get a name and find, you know, track down that person's family if that were relevant or important to do. And I think in, you know, Neapolitan Cult of the Dead, there's this interesting parallel between the Holy Souls in Purgatory and the Presepe, which is the Christmas nativity scene. But it's not just, you know, Mary and Joseph and baby Jay. It's this weird kind of expansion pack where there can be, you know, like up to, some people give 72 identities of the spirits that will appear in this nativity scene. And
yeah, great.
And it's not a significant number at all. But, you know, in addition to, you know, Mary and Joseph and Jesus and the three magi and, you know, the shepherds, you would also have, like, the butcher and the innkeeper and the washerwoman and, you know, the fishmonger. And each one of these figures has their own kind of cosmological significance. So the washerwoman, for example, because she stands at the river and because she takes things that are dirty and makes them clean, she's often associated with the cleansing of the holy souls in purgatory, the actual purgation that they're doing. Mm-hmm. Because the river, of course, is, you know, it's a chthonic thing. It may be sort of related to the fact that there's five rivers in the Greek underworld. But anything in a nativity scene from Naples that has water will be very explicitly understood as related to the underworld. So the river, the well, the lake, the waterfall. And so I think that that is a good starting point for people who are interested in what might a hierarchy of spirits that is indigenous to Southern Italy look like. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that that's like the alpha and the omega of, you know, Italian spirits and spiritism, but it is big enough and has a tradition of kind of informal Catholic gematria and, like, you know, putting together threads or pulling threads apart and kind of, you know, figuring out how do you map something from the spirit world, which is, you know, potentially unknowable to a human, into the human world. So that's probably the first place that I would recommend people just kind of get familiar with some of those faces and the body of lore that surrounds each one of them.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah. There could be, like, I like how you said kaleidoscopic, because at some point they became spiders or were communicating as spiders in some sense to people's consciousness, you know, so they're, you know, they may have, like, woven themselves enough into the landscape, you know, and that's where people were also so woven into through agriculture and through their personal experience, like you're saying, how to approach all these things and how to approach Catholicism in our own histories and in general, you know, they've kind of come back out the other side as spirits of place and as animal spirits and as.
Yeah. And I know a couple of people who talk about the spider as a personal totem, who are not in this tradition, who are not Southern Italian and don't really have that relationship with it, but they've explained to me how for them part of their magical practice is dealing with, if you imagine like wherever you go, you're constantly leaving a thread behind. Mm-hmm. What does your web look like? What do your daily movements look like when you're moving through your home, throughout your neighborhood, commuting to work, going to visit your family? What is the shape of this web? Because that's where you're going to be able to catch things, you know, spiritual influences mm-hmm. or spirits. And how can you use that to your advantage? How can you become, you know, more like the spider in terms of weaving this like metaphysical web where then you don't actually have to go out and go hunt the things yeah. that right. you want. You wait for them to come to you. And then like the spider, you feel it when it's tugging on the web somewhere, and then you can go and retrieve it.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's like doing any abundance magic. You want to make sure that you have all your stuff, all your cups like laid out to be filled, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I was talking about the Black Madonna in general and pilgrimage. It's as if like pilgrimage is kind of built into her origins in a way. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, well, I think she's on pilgrimage.
Yeah.
You right. know, it's an important part of her myth cycle often. And she's legion, you know, there's not just one Black Madonna.
Right.
But a lot of the Black Madonnas in Southern Italy are on this kind of Eleusinian trip where, you know, they come back in the spring and then they go somewhere in the fall and are sort of dormant during the winter. So Monte Vergine does this, for example. I think also there's some evidence that kind of suggests that some of the deities that are the most, the pagan deities that are the most strongly correlated with this tradition, so Dionysos and Cybele, were immigrants effectively from the East and not indigenous to Greek or Greek culture. And then, of course, you know, in Southern Italy, we're not in Greece anymore. These people are also immigrants. So like, you know, it's just, there's a lot of movement happening. I find that really interesting because it's another parallel sort of like with the, you know, the practitioner being the child of the Madonna, but also the mother of the mother of spirits. It's like, you know, we're all kind of immigrants. We're all moving around all the time. And like, so is God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Especially in magic, it's, you know, it's disparate parts always coming together. But even in the medieval period, it seems like within the church, Black was a sign of authenticity by being, showing that something was coming from Eastern origins.
Oh, that's really interesting. I never thought about it like that, but it is something that comes up a lot with the because the Madonnas in Southern Italy are there's like this really common sort of I guess archetype or motif which is we don't know where they come from. Usually they just sort of appear, and I mean the actual physical icons, the statues mm-hmm. or the paintings. One of my favorite stories is the Madonna delle Galline, who one day all of the hens, all of the chickens in this town, Pagani in Campania, just started like scratching at the same spot on the right. earth, which is kind of like, it's kind of a horror movie at this point, as far as I'm concerned. And like, you know, and I like to imagine, you know, first it was the chickens and then all the cows broke out of their pens like everything. And then finally like humans too were just clawing at the earth. And eventually they uncovered a painting and it turned out to be a miraculous image of the Madonna. But this means that like nobody really knows who the artist was that made any of these miraculous images or where they came from. And so often the style of the painting and like how, you know, the color of the skin of the Madonna and like how what she's depicted with, these are just like the only clues that we have to her origin, assuming that, you know, these aren't just miraculous paintings that, you know, have been generated by the earth. Like, you know, maybe the dwarves made it. I don't actually know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
but it's like, okay, either the dwarves or art history suggests that this is coming from
right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting. I was reading that in Notre Dame, like in the Virgin of Le Pieu, is that how you say it? Which is one of the most famous ones. It's not in Italy, but that even historically, it's attributed as being the first one, you know, the historical record, which just tracks like documents, right? The first time it was like, oh, this is a verified document that says this was a Black Madonna, is supposed to be this Madonna. And that it was destroyed during the French Revolution. And so the thing that we have to go on prior to that is people having done etchings and drawings and paintings of it. But before it was destroyed, they made a copy of it. And that's not the one on display. The one on display is someone trying to like remake the original one from memory. And it's much more crude. But there's an old one that's not it, that is like a copy of it that we maybe can assume looks closer to the original. And on both, like, you can't really tell like which came first, like black or white, as like going back through all these different versions of drawings and paintings of it. People either chose to paint it as black or chose to paint it as white. And there's like a, around the same time, there's a very old Madonna in Dijon that they've looked underneath. You know, there's like, oh, this is paint. It's painted black. So it must have been originally white. And they found that under that it was painted white. And under that it was originally black, you know? Like, and so I was thinking about how she's everything at once, like it almost like it's strobing sometimes rather than static black, you know. And we don't know an original like genesis of like, there's a story that comes up in a play of Claude d'Alesson, who's a playwright from this play like was performed from 1518 to 1521, that recounts the story of Saint Louis, and as the prophet Jeremiah fled to Egypt after the fall of the Temple of Jerusalem. In Egypt, he carved the Virgin of Le Pieu in a cave where he was hiding out in exile. And it ended up ceasing a plague in Egypt, and the Egyptians venerated it. And then years and years later, it went into the hands of a Babylonian king, and that Babylonian king gave it to Saint Louis. And that's how it ended up in France, and that's how it ended up in Europe in general. And obviously, this is just like what you're saying, like there's so many stories of how it came about, but that like black is that authenticity, that sign of going back to Eastern origins, you know, like has like pilgrimage as part of its mechanism, you know, like it's like this, like you're saying, this came from elsewhere. We have to go elsewhere to see it, to find it, you know.
Yeah, it's the relationship with the other, I think, and you know, seeking something beyond yourself, beyond what you know, beyond what you have ever dreamed was possible, that we find in this type of an image making tradition.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I just paused here in my notes. Yeah, there's so much to talk about. It's eventually you get kind of like caught up in the snare of it. Oh yeah, I was thinking earlier, kind of doubling back to what you were saying when we were talking about being in the circle and you know, magic needing to be done amongst other people, or be an interaction with people and them helping you to experience the medicine, like in the example of the possession. You had put a quote into our conversation before of, if you dance alone, you cannot heal.
And yeah.
Yeah, that was making me think about that a lot. And there was, I've been doing Italian on Duolingo, you know, on the phone, and and you can get like idioms. And one of the idioms they gave me translates to like, he who does it, like kind of like he who doesn't drink in company is either a thief or a spy, you know, that like reliance. Ooh. Reliance on like, it's sketchy if you're doing something by yourself, you know.
Yeah. Oh wow.
Like you're up to no good. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. The the "If you dance alone, you cannot heal." That is kind of the motto for a band called Canzoniere Grecanico Salentino, or CGS for short. And if anybody is interested in the, maybe we could include some musical pairings for this podcast in the show notes.
Totally. Great. Yeah.
But they are really incredible, and a lot of their music is rooted in the tradition, but a lot of it's also their own kind of reinterpretation of the tradition, or their own, their own musical innovation. It's their motto, and they say it at every show, and they kind of emphasize the curative, therapeutic power of music in everything that they do. And a lot of their music contains, a lot of kind of political themes related to, what does it mean to be Southern in Italy today? And the baggage that can go along with that, because it is an economically disadvantaged region, and a region that experiences a lot of oppression, usually in the form of Northern Italians, who are sometimes kind of hostile towards the culture and towards the people. I come back to that a lot, because I just find that magic is also a lot easier to do in a group. And I know it's hard to like keep a magical group like a coven operating smoothly for an extended period of time, but I think that's actually kind of part of the magic, is like it doesn't have a stable structure when you're doing magic, and it is kind of like constantly evolving and showing itself, revealing itself. I am always relying on my friends to kind of like, to bounce ideas off of, to talk about dreams with, to do divination for each other, to find books that the other one is interested in. And, it's one of the great joys of my life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like the divination, especially, you're just not going to get that reading that you would generate for yourself, and we turn to spirits often for that purpose, but then our friends and loved ones also are spirits,
Yeah. And that, a spirit might show up for one dude, alone in his basement. But it's certainly not going to mount him, because who's it going to talk to once it has incorporated?
Right. Yeah.
It's just going to be alone. And that sounds like awful. So it's really when you have a group of people together that, stuff really starts to happen. And it's beautiful.
Well, thanks very much for talking to us. I have so many more notes that we didn't get to. This is kind of like an endless conversation, but it seems like we kind of came to a good point.
Unless there's anything
that you would like to... Yeah, unless there's other directions you want to go.
I have a million things to talk about, but I think it's nice to end on friendship and on the motto that if you dance alone, you cannot heal.
Yeah, I thought absolutely. So as well, yeah. Well, thanks very much for joining us, and we definitely should talk more at some point. There's plenty to talk about, so maybe in a, as the astrology recontextualizes, more discussion, we'll throw this all back into like another mix.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, it's been really great talking to you guys.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next time.
All right, take care.